Chapter 34. The physical journey between my family's world and the capital of the Ecumene ordinarily takes less than 2 hours. For reasons not immediately explained to me, even traveling in the super-fast council ship, our trip took 3 days. All of space-time in this portion of the galaxy, perhaps all of the galaxy, was still disturbed. More than 15 times, we experienced the unavoidable effects of slip-space jump and reconciliation. An ordinary journey might have entailed one, or at most, 2 passages. The relief of being out of the possible clutches of the Master Builder seemed to open up substantial parts of my imprinting. Perhaps my other memory was coming to trust me as well. I stayed to myself, using the extra time to explore the possibilities of self-discovery and integration. My cabin became my universe. At last, certain streams within the Didact's memories of the Flood opened to me, a welcome if gradual flow of memory and knowledge. I had come to understand the Didact enough that his sympathy for vanquished humans and San Shum did not completely surprise me, and he had indeed felt sympathy, even regret. The war had not been a fair fight. With the Flood ravaging human systems on one side and a tide of human migration away from danger pushing them into Forerunner territories, a grand tragedy had been inevitable. The Didact felt this acutely. As to the nature of the Flood, in every natural circumstance, living things engage in competition. This is a prime directive for those who uphold the mantle. It is not a kindness to diminish competition, predation, even war. Life presents strife and death as well as joy and birth, but Forerunners, in their highest wisdom, also knew that unfair advantage, mindless destruction, pointless death and misery, and imbalance of forces can retard growth and reduce the flow of living time. Living time, the joy of life's interaction with the cosmos, was the foundation of the mantle itself, the origin of all its compelling rules. And the Flood seemed to demonstrate a tremendous imbalance, a cruel excess of depravities. Certainly humans and San Shum had felt that way. The Flood first arrived from one of the Magellanic clouds of stars that drift just outside the reaches of our galaxy. Its precise origin was unknown. Its first effects upon human systems in the far reaches of our arm of the galaxy were subtle, even benign, so it seemed. Humans suspected it was conveyed on ancient starships, clumsy in design but completely automated. The ships had neither passengers nor crew and carried little of interest but uniform kind of cargo, millions of glassy cylinders containing a fine, desiccated powder. Humans found wreckage of the ships on uninhabited and inhabited worlds alike. The cylinders were carefully examined, using the most stringent cautions, and their powdery contents were analyzed and found to be short-chain molecules, relatively simple and apparently inert, organic, yet neither alive nor capable of life. Early experiments demonstrated the potential for psychotropic effects in some lower animals, but not in humans or San Shum. The primary animals affected by the powder were, as it turned out, popular pets in human societies. The Feru, lively and gentle creatures first found on Fon Hakor. Very small quantities of the powder induced changes in the Feru that improved their domestic behavior, made them more affectionate, not so much docile as cleverly charismatic. Soon enough, on an emerging black market outside the control of human governments, Feru treated with these rare powders commanded a very high price. San Shum, at this point, also adopted Feru as pets. For centuries, dozens of human and San Shum worlds bred and powdered these animals without ill consequences. No researcher suspected the long-term effects of the powder, which attached itself to key points in the genes of Feru and began to change them, while at the same time improving their behaviors. What would soon become the Flood first manifested itself as a peculiar growth found on roughly 1/3 of all Feru treated with the powder, a kind of loose, soft fur grew between the shoulders of the pets. It was regarded by breeders as a natural mutation, even a pleasant variation. The sensuous quality of the fur particularly impressed the San Xiong, who crossbred these specimens. Other Feru were soon found grazing on these companions, consuming their fur, and on occasion even consuming the animals themselves. Feru were naturally herbivores. This seemed to activate some sort of biological timer, a signal for expansion. Within a very short time, the Feru were producing far less attractive growths. Flexible, striped rods sprouted from their heads, which in turn were also consumed by fellow Feru, causing abortions and unnatural births. There was no cure, but this was only the surface of the growing infestation. The Feru were soon past recovery. Humans and San Xiong dispatched their pets with regret and puzzlement, for these first stages were beyond their biological understanding. Most researchers believed the Feru had simply become overbred, over-specialized. A few were even returned to their native habitat on Phan Hakor. Then, humans began to manifest the growths. Some humans, it seemed, fancied Feru as food. These humans became vectors. Whatever they touched was also infected, and in time, what they discarded, limbs, tissue, could also spread infection. Thus began the flood. The plague soon spread from human to San Xiong, human to human, but rarely from San Xiong to human, altering their behaviors without yet changing their outward appearance. The infected humans combined their resources to force other humans to become infected, usually by cannibalism of a sacrificial individual, induced to grow to prodigious size before being consumed while still alive. By this time, dozens of worlds were fully infested and beyond saving. Humans and other animal species began to reshape themselves into other varied and vicious forms equipped to maim and kill and consume, absorb, transform. The infected worlds and even entire systems were quarantined. Many of the infected escaped, however, and spread the plague to hundreds of worlds in 15 systems. Humans were the first to recognize the extreme danger. And this was where the ancient captive in the precursor prison came into the story. Humans had discovered how to communicate with the captive, but only for seconds or minutes at a time. The earliest researchers tried to use it as a kind of oracle, asking the answers to vast and difficult questions of physics and even morality, all of which drew out confused or useless responses. But finally, a set of questions were prepared and asked. They asked about the flood. And what these humans received as answers traumatized them so thoroughly that many committed suicide rather than continue to live with their knowledge. In time, as a kind of defense, access to the captive was reduced, then cut off completely. The human time lock was added. Communication ceased. Most humans came to believe that the captive was an ancient aberration and had been imprisoned by the precursors for just cause, and that its prognostications, if they were such, were nonsensical, even mad. Humans, at the height of the flood's ravages, were pushed to an unexcelled brilliance. They found a cure. Here I detected in the documents the admiration of the life shaper herself. Sacrifice yet again. Fully a third of the human species must be themselves altered, placed in the pathway of flood infestation, and fight fire with fire by infecting the flood itself with a destructive set of programmed genes. The flood had no defense. Most of it died off. A few ships carrying the last of the flood escaped and left the galaxy once again, destinations unknown. By the time of this heroic struggle, humans were fighting forerunners as well. Humans were desperate. Their desperation made them cruel. They needed new worlds, uninfected worlds, and took them. Cruelty and apparently irrational conquest and destruction forced forerunners to react decisively. this double war was the source of the didact's shame. Though how he would have altered his conduct had he known was far from clear. Human forces were eradicated, and human-occupied worlds were reduced one by one until the Battle of Chaddam Hakor destroyed the last human resistance. The Sun Shum had already surrendered. None were found to be infected by this so-called plague. All the powdered and infested specimens of the Feru were long dead, destroyed. The original vessels that had carried the glass containers were also destroyed, perhaps in the perverse human wish that forerunners would face a similar infestation and be unprepared. Many forerunners, in fact, regarded the entire story of the Flood, for that was the name humans gave to this spreading infestation, this intergalactic disease, as a fabrication designed to absolve humans and Sun Shum of blame. The rest of the story I knew, or had deduced, and my knowledge matched the didact's. The librarian was allowed to preserve some human specimens, and to preserve the memory traces of many others, a procedure regarded with much dissent and disgust by orthodox observers of the mantle. But the possibility of the return of the Flood initiated the events which shaped Forerunner history up to my own time, and most of it, nearly all of it, was kept secret by the Master Builder and his guild, my father included. Only a few sympathetic counselors were fully informed. Thus began the conflict with the Prometheans. The Didact proposed vigilance and research, and upon any return of the Flood, however it might manifest, a systematic isolation of infected worlds and, if necessary, immolation. He proposed establishing fortress worlds, shield worlds, across the Forerunner-dominated portions of our galaxy to monitor potential outbreaks and be prepared to fight them with pinpoint precision and minimum destruction. Others had more ambitious solutions. The Didact and the Prometheans faced off against the most extreme faction of builders, now in complete control of the Council. This faction saw both an opportunity to create ultimate weapons against such a threat and a way to maximize and make permanent their political power at the same time. Thus, my father and the Master Builder began to design a series of installations, far fewer in number than the proposed shield worlds, that would become the Halos. By radiating a powerful burst of cross-phased supermassive neutrinos, these installations were capable of destroying all life in an entire star system. Properly tuned and powered, they could do more than that. They could kill all neurologically complex life across whole swaths of the galaxy. The extreme faction won. Fear commanded the Council, and the Council listened. The Didact lost his political battle and was forced into exile. Over the next 1,000 years, 12 such installations were built. Their point of construction was far outside the galaxy, on a superior installation known as the Ark. It acquired that name because of the growing backlash of influence rising from life workers, and in particular from the life shaper herself, the librarian. She insisted that not to make provisions against the ultimate use of the Halos was blasphemy against the mantle. Life workers had their own kind of influence. If they stood down, all medical efforts could cease. The Master Builder saw that giving in to her demands was less expensive than fighting her. And so, the librarian was allowed to gather specimens and recreate their ecological conditions on the Ark itself, even as the Ark finished and transported the first Halos. Utilizing a powerful variety of locked point slipspace transit called portals. The installations had been dispersed. The Halo tested at Chaddam Hakor had been fired at very low power, acting as a test bed. That had been an authorized use. But then a second Halo had been used to punish the Sun Shum. With horror, I realized that what I had witnessed had been only the beginning, and that the Sun Shum worlds, after our brief traumatic visit, had been reduced to the awful condition of biological blandness we had seen on Fawn Hakor. The council had not authorized this use. The master builder had exceeded his authority. He had been accused, even by his colleagues, of blasphemy against the mantle and a crime against nature. What the didact could not understand at the time of my mentoring was why the librarian had chosen this moment to gather specimens from the Sanshum, taking the risk of provoking their rebellion and the master builder's wrath. I found that answer in the council records with the help of my expanded and liberated Ancilla. 300 years before, the flood had returned. It had been discovered in new and unexpected forms on worlds resettled by forerunners after the war. I was caught in a twisted knot of contradictions. Faced with the reality of the flood, I couldn't help but think that the madness of those who had manufactured the halos and set them loose might be the right course. A solid goal, a solid plan, extreme measures against an extreme enemy, fighting for survival against a shapeless threat. The mantle be damned, survival and our way of life was at stake. It all seemed eminently rational. I almost began to believe that it was the didact who was mad, and possibly these young counselors, and not the master builder or my father. Finally, in fury and frustration, I divested myself of my armor, deliberately cutting off contact with the Ancilla, whom I thought had failed me or misled me again. And I slept. If I was in search of peace and certainty, that was my mistake. The didact's actual memories, parts of them, finally blossomed within me.
The arena was equipped with walkways.
I saw vividly, from his point of view, the didact exploring the walkway around the intact, sealed cylinder below.
10,000 years ago.
The didact walked alone around the dome-shaped cap, contemplating whether or not he should activate a human device, something small, designed for a human hand, and fitting like a toy into his own palm. A way of communicating directly with the creature within the cell.
Something manufactured by humans, pushing through precursor technology. How is that possible?
Many questions flashed through the didact's mind, and with difficulty I separated them from my own. Was this actually a precursor, as the humans had at first believed? Or was it something manufactured by precursors? Possibly a strange, distorted sibling to both forerunners and, the didact was reluctant to consider this, humans. Precursor, sibling, or ancestor to what? The didact manipulated the device. The cap over the cylinder became transparent to his eyes, and he saw what lay within. The cell contained, in temporal suspension, a genuine monster, a large creature with an overall anatomy like a grossly misshapen human, though possessed of 4 upper limbs, 2 degenerate legs, and an almost indescribably ugly head. A head shaped remarkably like that of an ancient arthropod seeded long ago on a number of planets, presumably by the precursors, and known to some as Eurypterid, a sea scorpion. Oval, faceted, slanted eyes bumped up from the front of its low, flat face, and from the rear of the head, a long, segmented tail descended the spine, ending in a wicked barb, 2 meters in length. A chime pulled me up short. Disoriented, shivering, unsure who or even what I was, I looked around my cabin, saw my armor slumped in one corner, and a ship's Ancilla blinking rapidly in another. We had finally reached the capital. Even with the extended journey, there had not been enough time to fully integrate. Without the domain, integration might forever elude me, and inside I would always be a fragmented jumble. I tried to recall all that I had seen. Most of it was fading already. I had only a vague impression of the captive. Vague, but frightful. Clearly, those questions that the didact had not resolved to his own satisfaction were more difficult to flush out. But the process had somehow pushed forward a question neither I nor my other memory could answer. Why would they need me if the didact himself had been released and reinstated? Why not go directly to him?